This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mr. William Franklin, better known, I believe, as Bill. We are recording at his office at 158 West Prairie Avenue, that is the Decatur Club, in Decatur, Illinois, on March 18, 1986. Well, Bill, I'm going to call you Bill, too, because...
Thank you.
We seem to be good friends, even though we haven't known each other very long. I happen to know that you're not a native of Decatur. When did you come to Decatur?
We came in 1936, and the reason was my father was a salesman with the Mobil Oil Company, and at that time it was called the Saucony Vacuum Oil Company, and before that it was the Vacuum Oil Company, and they got together with the Standard Oil Company of New York, and they said, we're now the Saucony Vacuum, so they transferred him over to this area.
It sounds as if the recent troubles of oil companies are not new.
They had mergers back then.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It has always been a rather, to make a bad pun, fluid industry.
Yeah, that's very fluid, yes. Uh-huh. And so that's why we moved here.
Uh-huh. Well, where did you come from?
We came from Danville, Illinois. And I remember when we got here, I thought it was terrible because I'm leaving friends in school, and I thought there's no way I can make friends again and play ball like I played over there with them in grade school. But I found out that was wrong.
About what year were you?
I think I was in the last half of the sixth grade.
So was a hard time to leave.
Well, it was, for me it was, because I had made, as I said, friends playing baseball, and I was just learning how to play tennis, and But an interesting thing on that, I came to a school, and it was called St. Patrick's Grade School, and they had double desks, and I had never sat at a double desk in my life, and I kept looking over at the other fellow's desk all the time, and the nun kept saying, no, you don't do that, William. So I soon learned that you didn't look and see what the other student had written down.
Right. But you did make good friends here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Then you continued schooling here?
Continued schooling, and it was interesting, though, at the sixth grade level, eighth grades was all you went to the Catholic school, and my one sister was in the eighth grade, and we had a spelling bee contest one time, and our sixth grade beat the eighth grade, and I was so pleased because my sister was against me, and we got to brag a little bit at home how we beat her.
Right.
But it was fun. Interesting thing too, starting the seventh year, I was transferred over to another grade school, and I asked my mother, I said, why are you transferring me to St. James? Well, they don't fight as much over there. I never knew anything about the fights at St. Pat's because I was never in any. So that was the immediate transfer from Danville, and you get to learn and know people, and it was nice. And I was always used to nuns anyway, all the way up through, and we never had any what we call lay teachers back then. And I think things have changed. I believe now it's mainly lay teachers, and you might find one nun in the school. What grade she would be teaching, I don't know.
Okay. Did you go to high school in Decatur?
Went to the public high school. My sisters went to the Catholic high school, and I remember a teacher named Sister Clotil. She was in charge of St. Teresa's, and she would ask me every time I would maybe go out to see my sisters, for what reason I don't know at the high school, but she would say, William, why aren't you out here? And I said, well, honestly, sister, all my friends are going to the public high school, so that's where I went. So that was my start of going to a public school.
Did you go into business from high school?
No, right from high school. I got a job that summer and knew I wanted to go to college, and World War II had been declared 6 months before I graduated, and I knew I'd be going into service, but the main thing was I wanted to start college, and so I got a summer job and got to start at Milliken, and I got it 1 year in at Milliken before I went into service. And it's interesting when I talk to clients about the costs of education, and I said, back then, I earned my full year in that summer. And I said, it cost me a grand total of $240 a year to go out to Milliken for that first year, $120 a semester. And today, people can't believe that they were that low at one time. And I got by from my books and all fees for the full $300 that I earned that summer.
Of course, you lived at home.
I lived at home, yes.
So you saved that.
Oh, I saved that, you betcha. And I was real happy. I didn't want to ask my father for any money to go to college because I remember how tough it was, him putting my sister through. And I felt pleased that I could do that. And then by that second year, I knew I would be going into service because I had enlisted in the Navy when I was in college, and they finally called me, and I went to the Navy, did nothing to help the war effort, but I was in. And then when I came out, I went back to Milliken and finished up.
Did you spend your time on the seas during the Navy?
Only 6 months. I was basically around the United States. As I said, I didn't do anything. If they had counted on me, we'd have probably lost the war. But anyway, they didn't. But it was different. It was a time, I guess, we all had to do something, and I just did whatever they told me to do.
Uh-huh. So then...
It was interesting, when I was in my freshman year at college, this is 1942, eventually I played baseball at Milliken my freshman year, and I loved baseball so much I would sometimes sneak out of the lab at Milliken. And to do that, you had to climb across the roof and down a fire escape to do it, to get over to practice early. And at that time, we had to clean the field and drag it and rake it to have it ready for ball games. Today, they have people doing that for them. But back then, we had to clean it up ourselves. And I always remember, I loved baseball so much, I never minded cleaning the field and getting ready for a game. So that to me was interesting, and also in my first year I never knew anything about farming, and here I lived in a farming community, and I got to play ball with some guys who came from farms. Yet they told me things that went on in the farms and never realized, you know, etc. And it was very interesting to meet people of different walks of life. Finally, when I got out of service, I knew I wanted a business of my own eventually, but I didn't know what. So when I got out of college, it was immediately, I was going out looking for a job, and I remember my first job was $75 a week, and I thought, gee, that's a lot of money, $300 a month. But I found out it really wasn't, but I thought it was. And I was a so-called office manager of a trucking firm. And I realized that I can't go anywhere here because I've learned basically in doing what I'm supposed to do, but I'm not seeing any future for myself. Finally had a chance to buy a service station, and another young man who was in college at the time said, why don't we become partners, and when I graduate, I'll go in with you. And we did, and we ran the station for 2 years together. Then I bought him out, and in the last year, I started talking to a general agent in the insurance business, and he said, you ought to consider insurance as a career. You got very good background. So I started reading books. So for a whole year I was reading books on insurance, and I got so fascinated with the idea you could put away money and have money returned to you when you're 65, all the money you'd given the company plus a gain, and in the meantime have insurance. I thought, gee, this thing is marvelous. This is like a miracle. And I got real enthused with that idea. And that's how I got started in the insurance business once I sold my service station. And I liked it. And I've loved it ever since.
So you happened into the right career. I'm
hoping my clients believe that. I believe it.
Well, this is the 65th program that I have recorded.
Wow.
And you're the first insurance person that I've talked to.
Well, there are a lot better ones around than me.
I want to remedy that situation. I'm sorry I haven't done this sooner. But tell me, I imagine the insurance business has had a lot to do with the development of the Decatur.
I don't know that answer. In my business, it's mainly insuring lives. I am not like a property man or a car insurance salesman. So that particular field I'm not into, but people still think about their families, and that's why they buy life insurance, and they still say, I would like to have some money when I'm older, and that's another reason for buying life insurance, and I haven't seen any change in that principle. I have seen where youngsters seem to want to start where their parents have left off, but maybe that's big ideals, and maybe everyone should have big ideals. It's just that I hope they don't get too disappointed if they don't have them immediately.
We hear a great deal about the breakup of family life. Seems to me you are probably pretty close to families. Do you see that there is an alarming change in attitude toward family life?
The only thing I see, I tease my clients, if they're brand new and we're doing business for the first time, I tell them, I say, there's two requirements if I'm going to be your agent. And they look at me like, what are you, you're telling us that we have to do something? And I say, number one, you can't change banks because there's more forms that you get me all fouled up with. So don't change banks. Stick with a bank. And I said, number two is don't get a divorce. I said, because that takes more forms and it just fouls up my records completely, see? And I say, I love you both and I don't want to see you separate. Oh, definitely we're not going to get a divorce. We just got married. And I find out years later that this is not necessarily true. They do break up, and I remind them, I say, I told you don't change banks. I told you don't get a divorce. And I have noticed a breakup more frequent than original. The Y elements, heavens, you got guys that are experts on that. Maybe it's just that they're not trying as hard as they should try. Maybe each one wants more than the other can provide. I don't know. But yes, I do notice it. The tough part about my profession, I consider myself a professional, and I can't tell your personal business even to your mother if she would ask me, because I would say, gee, you'll have to ask Betty, because I don't know what you're talking about there. And it's all personal between the two of us. And this is tough, because every now and then you'll get a close friends say, well, what did she do on her insurance? And I said, gee, I don't know. I have to do this because it's personal. But I've also had my mothers and fathers get very upset with me why I wouldn't answer their question what their son or daughter did. And I always have to say, why don't you ask them? Let them tell you. And then I even tell the son or daughter, please, if your parents ask and I say no to them, you'll understand why. You have to tell me to tell them.
I can see that your choice of the area of insurance that you went into could be extremely satisfying, since you're always working with people and their personal experiences.
Yes.
But maybe we should stop, and maybe you could just tell me some of the other types of insurance.
Well, then, people sometimes are worried, what if they become disabled physically or mentally where they can't earn a living? They're maybe laid off work because of that disability. So then we have what we call a disability income insurance. And so that's protecting against a long illness. One case that I had that is not actually disability income insurance, but is related to it. In our business of life insurance, we have what we call a waiver of premium. And what that means is if you become disabled, the insurance company will step in and pay the premium for you. So you're insuring against that premium being paid. And the interesting one that I said that the first case I ever had of this happening, I had to pursue it because I said, I think this man's disabled. And so I wrote to the company and I said, I'm pretty sure he literally can't work for a living, but I don't know how you view this. And his problem was alcohol, and it just knocked him out completely of doing his professional job. And so they wrote back and asked the particulars, and I said, well, he literally hasn't been practicing his profession for 6 months. And they said, give us the name of the doctors, and by golly, they waived his premium for a total of 2 years. I'll never forget this because his father was so happy for what I had done for his son, he said, now you let me know if there's any problem of this being paid for. That was a nice feeling inside me to do something there that really paid off, because otherwise they'd have never known there's a disability that would be paying for the premiums.
Did the insurance company ask him to have treatment?
Yes, and then they'll even ask for a re-evaluation every year. Or they have a right to ask for it every 6 months. But little things like that are deep down make you feel good, that you save something that maybe couldn't have been saved. And to this day, he has increased his purchase of insurance with me, his son.
He conquered his problem.
Yes, he conquered his problem, and that was a good feeling, too. And he's just a nice young man, as far as when I say nice young man, he's under 50.
Right.
So, yes, those are nice feelings.
I can see that, in a way, you act as a kind of personal counselor as well as a salesman.
Well, I think in the life insurance business, we get this way because we have to be pretty knowledgeable on different areas, such as Social Security. I remember the first death claim that I was on, that I literally sold the insurance to the husband. I walked the widow right down to the Social Security office. To this day, she'll bring it up among friends and say, Bill was so helpful to me when that happened. And that's a nice feeling to know that you help walk a person through some problems. Another one, I remember a widow, she says, Bill, I want you to go down with me to the funeral home. And she says, I just don't want any of my family with me, please. And so I went down there, and Jiminy Crickets, I'm a greenhorn. I've never been in a funeral home, but I do know the rumors that they used to say, oh, look out because they'll sell you the expensive casket, et cetera, et cetera. And so all I did was try and say, I think he would be happy with this one, and I think what you want to do is conserve as much money as you can for the family. And years later, she would remark, Bill, I sure appreciate your doing that. These are little nice things that you get a good feeling out of.
Speaking of Social Security, are you as involved in the red tape of government as the average person seems to be?
No.
You are able to figure it out.
Well, what a lot of insurance men will do is they'll rule of thumb things. They'll say, as an example, if something happens to your husband and you have these two children here, you would probably receive $800 a month. Now, you might receive $794, but we don't think there's that much difference, or you might receive $805. We want you to understand the principles of what you will get, and the same thing to understand the principles of, if you continue on the same capacity, what you would have at retirement, so that you say to yourself, is that enough? Where do I make up the difference? How do I make up the difference? Where can your product solve my problem? So in a way, I guess we're problem solvers. Mm-hmm. At least we try to be.
And you think that the government has helped?
The government and Social Security has helped a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who would never put away money, mm-hmm. and this way they're forced to. I remember in Decatur one time talking to a man who was involved with a well-known factory in Decatur, and I said to him, I said, when you're dealing with the union, why don't you just say, we'll give the money to the union man and let him put the money away into his own pension. He said, the union officials said to him, they'd never save it, so we better put it into a pension for their own good. Well, I think we're all a little bit like that. Unless we're forced, we may not never put it away. We may not even do the right thing unless we're forced to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. So a little forced savings is kind of what life insurance is all about.
There have been a lot of stories about insurance business lately, maybe not your part of it exactly, but high awards and so on.
I think what you're hearing, Betty, is it's in regards to what they call liability insurance. And no, that is not my field, but what people want to remember, an insurance company, and I'm talking now about stock insurance companies. Stock insurance companies is a firm that incorporates to make money. That's why they went in the business. Now, we're not that type. We're a mutual company, meaning all the policyholders are the stockholders. But a stock company goes into business to make money. Now, if they charge you a premium, they're saying, we're doing you a favor, but you're also doing us a favor by buying, because we can eventually make money off of this. But if what they're insuring you for, too many awards come about from court proceedings, from under the table proceedings, because they say we'll settle out of court, if it goes more than what they, in my terminology, I would call actuary scale, if it goes more than what they think would be normal for that year, then they say, wow, we've lost money. Well, now, you can't lose money too long and stay in business. Then they'll come back and say, well, Betty, we've got to charge you more. Now, naturally, Betty says, I don't want to pay more. I haven't had any problem. Well, we know you haven't had a problem, but what the insurance company does is they take a million people and they put it together and they say, this is what the claim ratio should be for a million people. And if it gets above that, then they say they have to have more money. Well, now we have astronomical awards being made that insurance companies never counted on. Plus, I think a bad thing is a moral obligation. Today's paper, as an example, had an article in there that two youngsters drowned. I don't know if you read that article or not.
Oh,
was that tragic? They said the person that saw it said, gee, I don't want to get involved. They're liable to, and you think, you get away from this thing, I want to help you. Like if I see someone hit you with a car and I go to pick you up, they say, gee, I better not pick her up because if I hurt her, she'll sue me. Now, isn't that too bad? I would try and say, try and help the person and baloney to this stuff. But the insurance companies are seeing what they see as awards that they thought would never be around. So I don't know the answer, Betty, on that question you asked. That's a problem within not only the industry, but the people have got to realize if you don't like what the insurance company is doing, take a chance on your own or form your own mutual group and say, we'll protect each other.
It seems to me as if people are afraid to face the consequences.
Yes,
thinking that nothing should ever go wrong.
Yeah, right. I remember an article I read one time, they said, it's going to get to the point where a child someday will sue its parents, say, you didn't bring me up right.
Well, actually, they have sued teachers.
Yes, and I say to myself, gee, this is too bad. I think as long as you're not trying to hurt someone, there might be times that I would speak harshly to you, but I don't think that means necessarily that you should say, he's trying to hurt me, I'll sue him. Or maybe harshly with a child, you might turn him over your knee and whack him good. You didn't mean to hurt him. You're trying to say, please remember the lesson so we don't do this again. I guess we have a penal system that says, you go to jail, we hope you will remember the lesson so you never do it again.
Maybe you could tell us, have you had any, what you've already told us, two or three cases about people who've been helped. Are there any other dramatic stories or stories that you remember about ways that you have helped people or problems that people have encountered?
Well, the first experience I ever had of settling a death claim was one that I hadn't sold, but I had gone to school with a man who had died. He died very young. I think he was probably under 35 years old. To me, that is very young. He left a wife and two children. And I remember being asked, will you please help settle this death claim? Meaning I had to go out and see the widow, I had to go out and get some form signed, I had to ask her how she wanted the money. And I made recommendations to her to just leave it at interest for a while until she makes her decisions and don't rush into taking the money and maybe making some bad choices. And so I remember saying to her, if any of the relatives or the friends at the funeral say, how much insurance did he leave? I said, just tell him that he left it in trust and you really don't know. And I said, that'll get you off the hook of answering a very personal question because it's really none of the relatives' business how much money or insurance was left. And she looked at me and she said, oh, I never thought of that. And I said, well, you won't be lying because he's leaving it in trust to you to take care of it. And she said, oh, well, so anyway, point I said to her was so that she won't get involved with family. And the thing that hurt worse than anything is she came to see me later and 50% of the money that had been left in insurance, she said, Bill, I want to take that out. And I said, fine. I said, any particular reason I can help you with? And she said, well, her brother was going to go into this business and he needed so much money and he asked me if I had any money and I said, yes. And so he said, and I'll give you a good interest on this, sis, blah, blah. the end result of the story, within 2 years, all of the insurance money her husband left for her to bring the kids up was down the drain, and the brother said to her, well, sis, you know, if we'd have made it, I'd have paid you, but, you know. Now, that doesn't help the person. So that my point of the whole story to people is somehow get it in trust and put it aside where your best friends, your relatives, who all of a sudden think you've got money, you just say, I'm sorry, I cannot put my hands on it. It's been left in trust. Now, I don't know if you'd call that dramatic, but to me, that was a dramatic example of my relatives would never hurt me, they love me. Well, that's a bunch of malarkey. If they got your money, they can always say, I'm sorry, I can't give it back, I don't have it anymore.
I don't know whether you have children who are in the insurance
business.
Yes,
ma'am. Three children, and none of them are in the insurance business, and once in a while they listen to me on my insurance ideas.
If you were advising some young person wanting to go in the insurance business, what suggestions would you give?
Well, basically, number one, I'd go to college, and I'd try and take as many business courses as possible, and as many psychology courses as possible, because you're going to be dealing with people. And I'd even try to get my license as early as possible so I could sell part-time while going to school, so I could get the feel of it by the time I graduated. And I think it's a wonderful profession. I don't think it's anything that's ever going to go down the drain. I don't think there's going to be any other way to solve the problem, because it really is people getting together to solve a problem. That's what an insurance company is, a whole bunch of people that say, I'll chip into the same pot, and if we have a problem, we'll pull out of that pot. That's what an automobile insurance company is. They say, we'll chip into the pot. If there's a claim, we'll pull it out of the pot. So that's why I loved it. You can't hurt people. You make them put away money, and they have money later on when they're older, and they say, you mean I get all this back? I've teased people many times. I said, you know, it makes me mad. I'm a good driver. I don't get in car wrecks. But I'll bet you when I reach, say, 70 years old and say I'm not going to drive a car anymore, if I went up to my car insurance man and say, would you give me all my premiums back? I haven't had any wrecks. He'd probably say, you must be nuts. But we life insurance man will do that. We'll give the client back all the money they've given us plus a gain. That's a good feeling, Betty, a good feeling inside. So I love the business, and I would tell youngsters, it's a great business. But you got to remember, it's not as easy as people think. If it were, everybody would be in it. A lot of times you get people saying no to you, and you don't like a no. A no hurts your feelings. Well, what I say is, everybody's not going to believe you 100%, but if you talk to enough people, pretty soon they will.
You have to be a salesman, don't you?
Gosh, I don't know. I've always wanted to be, but I don't know if I am or not.
And it seems to
I just love it.
You have to have a natural ability to sell or to meet people.
I think you have to like people and want to solve their problems and want to, yes, I think that. I don't think you can just do it to say it's a job. In fact, I feel sorry for anybody that just has a job.
When you first came to Decatur, how different was the city?
I don't think the city was any different. Remember, when you're a youngster, eventually you can adjust to anything. Something, my neighbor up the block, something he and I used to do in the wintertime that we had more fun to barrel monkeys. If it snowed and there was enough snow on the street, we had our sleds, and what we would do, we would hop on the back of a bus and hang onto the bumper, and we'd ride from the west end of town uptown, dropping off right before we hit the center part of town, and then we'd catch them on the way back. Now, this was a no-no. Our parents would have probably clobbered us if they'd known what we were doing. We thought it was the greatest thing in the world. It'd be pulled all over town on a bus. So it was fun. It was fun. Today, I think you have too crowded of a conditions. I think if the bus driver knew you're back there, you're liable to end up in jail because they'd be afraid of the liability. And this is another interesting thing to me. I remember when I was in junior high school, we had just been lectured by the teacher in the woodworking shop. Do not... two of you go to a machine at the same time, just one. And he said, because what'll happen is you'll start messing around, someone's going to get hurt. And I said, at this one machine, after this lecture, I'm changing the belt, which was a V-belt driven drill machine. I'm just changing the belt so it could go at a different speed. Wouldn't you know, my friend walks up and turns the machine on, and my finger goes zoom, and it cuts the tendon of my finger. The point I'm getting to is, when I get to the doctor, they sew it up, everything's fine. Today, some parents liable to say, I'm going to sue that other boy's parents, or I'm going to sue the school. I just considered it a dumb accident. Mm-hmm. Never even thought of a suit, wouldn't think of a suit. You got hurt, you got hurt. I think the same thing if I was playing in your yard and I tripped over and banged my head, I'm not going to sue you because I tripped in your yard. We didn't think of it that way. I think today people are conscious of, well, they must have insurance, I'll go after them and get it. It won't be out of their pocket, it'll be out of the insurance pocket. But that's like saying, if I steal, it won't be out of my friend's pocket, but eventually it's out of all of us taxpayers because we have to hire more policemen to protect us against the bad guy. So we all pay for bad. And same way with insurance. We all pay for the bad, and I don't think anyone should try and take advantage of anybody in any situation. Of course, I'm an idealist on that.
Well, that's a good attitude for an insurance man.
Well, I want you to take care of your family, because if you take care of your family, really, I don't have to take care of you when you get older.
Have you always had an office in downtown Decatur?
Always has been downtown Decatur. We originally were at the Citizens Building, which is over in the heart of our downtown mall. And when I was in that, I was single, and I think maybe a year or two there. Then when I got married and came back from the honeymoon, we had moved over here to the Decatur Club. And originally, we were across the hall when they used to have a stairway over there. Our office was across the hall, and part of it was actually under the stairwell. And they blocked off the stairwell now. You don't even know it existed. And we're now over in an area that the Association of Commerce used to have their office. And I liked it. Mainly your office is really with your clients. Mm-hmm. This is just a place you get some of your work done and keep your files and answer the phone, etc.
Downtown Decatur seems to have had its problems, as all downtown areas are having in cities these days. Do you see any way out, or what do you think is going to happen to the downtown area?
Well, I have confidence in the same old story. If you have a good business and you run it well, I think people will come to you. I don't think you can expect because you open a business people will come to you. You have to run a good business, offer a good product, and make people want to come to you. I remember my father-in-law saying one time that people always used to talk about location, location. He said, if something's good enough, people will come to you. And he says, all you got to do is look where someone maybe has put a store out in the middle of a cornfield, and if it's good enough, people will go out to the middle of that cornfield and do business with them. And basically, people shouldn't say, I have to have location. You run a good business, people will come to you. So we have to hope that people downtown will try to run a good business and want to build that business and not just be what I call takers, kind of give back to the community and maybe not only do their own business, but try to make sure the businesses around them are operating good and working hard to get the people down. No, I don't see a downgrading of Decatur. I think Decatur is a fine community, and the best way to keep it fine is to keep positive thinking.
Do your children live in Decatur?
I have one child in Decatur, and that's the male. And I have two girls, and they both went where their husbands got employed. One was in Colorado, and the other's in Arkansas. And they all seem happy, but they were all educated right around here.
And you have grandchildren?
And I'm lucky enough to have three grandchildren and one in the hopper. So it's real nice.
You have some grandchildren living in Decatur?
I have two grandchildren in Decatur, which is real great because, as I've told many people, it is a joy to watch them. In my business, I was out a lot of nights in the early years when my kids were growing up, So I didn't get to see some of the things of watching them grow up. Now I can stare at my grandkids, and especially if they act up, I can just sit back and smile. That's Mommy and Daddy got to take care of that problem. But I get to see some of the things that I really didn't get to see with my kids.
Well, from what you've said, evidently you think your grandchildren are going to do all right in Decatur.
Oh, I think the educational system, I think, is great around here. Mm-hmm. And then again, remember, part of education is still at home. If Mommy and Daddy don't do it, you can't count on the schools to do it altogether. And so, and the friends you go with, the friends you have your kids play with, I think that's all important. So it's all, it's in other words, everybody working together. That's the whole point of it. Like in my insurance here, I have the product, but if you're not going to pay for it, I can't help you. So you do your part, I'll do my part, and if everybody in the community says the same thing, they get involved in the schools, help with the Parent Teachers Association, help when a teacher calls up and says, I've got a problem with your child, go see what's going on, and kind of cooperate. I get a kick when someone says, boy, that teacher is terrible. I think what they're doing is trying to lay the blame instead of saying, maybe my child isn't the real cooperating person he should be or she should be. In the same way within a community. I think we got to all try and help each other. If that's answering your question, Betty.
Well, Bill, I really thank you for sharing your experiences and reminiscences with us. And it is very uplifting to talk to someone who seems so enthusiastic about his work after the years you've spent in it.
Good.
And about the community and the American family. It really is a pleasure to talk to someone who has that attitude. And
good.
We thank you for helping us out.
Betty, I just thank you for asking me.
You have been listening to the reminiscences of Bill Franklin, and this is Betty Turnell.